is generational. Like, I think we just have a different understanding of that now. But I'm encouraged to know that I feel like that's changing culturally. We're starting to have a different awareness of it.
I think people have the best of intentions by ignoring the obvious. You know, no one goes out to make a kid feel like they're not adequate or not good enough, but by not talking about the issues where they may be feeling they're not good enough, or they're struggling with something that other people find easy, to dismiss that or to discount it or just to ignore it, I think is a disservice. I know it's a disservice to the kids. It's hard to talk about big topics, but once you get a relationship going with a kid, especially one like this young man I'm talking about, it gives them a sense of trust with an adult, or hopefully more than one. But it really is something that just opens up their minds and their worlds, that, okay, I can talk about this. I don't have to hide it anymore. And if anyone's making fun of this kid, I haven't seen it. But again, the social issues that come into play need to be discussed with that kid, just to get their views on what's going on and maybe how I can help.
I think part of the benefit of establishing that baseline of talking about it and normalizing those conversations is that opens the gateway for self-advocacy, mm-hmm. which is so important for our kids. I think so many of them feel like they don't have that autonomy to ask for what they need. So if it's a very bright kid who needs more rigorous academic challenges, or if it's a child who needs accommodations, being able to self-advocate is really empowering for them. But if we ignore it or turn a blind eye, they feel like it's something maybe to be ashamed of or that they shouldn't address it.
One of the people who was foundational in my own learning was a man named William Perkey, which is a great name to have considering his personality. But he wrote a book probably in the 1970s, I don't know, 1980s, called Inviting School Success. And it's still on my bookshelf and I still use it. I reference it in my own writing. And very briefly, let me talk about what he mentions in that book that is, I think it's foundational for my own career, and I think it's instructive for others, especially educators. He talks about there's only four types of educators in the world. And the first one is an intentional inviter. And this is the best teacher you've ever had. These are the teachers who know who you are. They make a connection. They value that connection. And they move forward with you. They know what they're doing. When they're wrong, they admit it. And so the intentional inviter is the teacher you remember as always being in your corner. Okay. Then there's the unintentional inviter. And these are teachers who really do good things with kids, but they don't have a gestalt. They don't have a pattern. They just try something. If it works, they do it again. So they're really good, but they're scattered in terms of their effectiveness with kids. All right. So the unintentional inviter, the goal is to help them become more intentional. But again, they're good teachers. Oftentimes they're younger. They're trying to test things out to see what works and what doesn't. But they don't have a whole bag of tricks yet, if you will. The third is the unintentional disinviter. And this is where I think a lot of the neurodiverse kids see these teachers. For example, it would be a teacher who, you know, gives a math quiz and then the next day comes in and says, there was only one A on this quiz. Can anyone guess who got it? Now, some kids will love that. Other kids will just shrink into their seat. Okay, so the unintentional disinviter does things or